Welcome to episode number 26 of the Inside Running Podcast. Thanks for joining us for another week. Thanks for downloading the show. This week is sponsored by some amazing, I think we're calling them patrons, who went over to our Patreon page when we launched it last week and signed up to be subscribers of our extra, no, the Inside Running Extra Elite level of sponsorship. And we thought we'd acknowledge them on the show this week because we're stoked that they're on board and we're stoked that they're putting some money where their mouths are, I suppose, and yeah, chipping in to support the show. So big thanks to Chris Rancey. He was one of the first people to contribute. I know Chris personally. You know Chris too, don't you, Julian?
Yes, had a few interactions with Chris.
He's a good boy. He used to be a pretty decent triathlete. Did you know that?
No, but why would I?
Surprise. Right. Surprise you do know him then. Nah, he's a good bloke, good run. He's running Gold Coast this year as well. He's gearing up for a big one. So thanks to Chris, Steve and Tona. I don't know Steven personally, but thank you, Steven, for chipping in. Stu McCauley, thank you very much. Ian Fisher, Dion Birtwistle. We were just talking off air if he's any relation to Jake Birtwistle, the silver medalist in the triathlon at the Commonwealth Games and the gold medalist in the team section, I think. But we didn't come up with an answer there, did we, boys?
No, hopefully he can let us know himself on our Facebook page, maybe.
Yeah.
Or somebody that knows him.
Yeah, someone down in Tassie might know him. That could come in handy if he is any relation. We might be able to tee up Jake for an interview. Ben Pearson, one of Atchukamoama's finest people, spends half his wage every week at the running company down in Ballarat, so good for him to donate. Daniel Craig.
Sausage roll boy.
So, yeah, doesn't mind a sausage roll on his way down to Ballarat. Daniel Craig, gun athlete. I've been helping Daniel with his program the last couple of months, so I appreciate his support. Running well, too. Running really well. Got a big PB coming at the end of the year, I reckon, as well. Jeff is Spister. I hope I haven't murdered your last name there, Jeff, but we see your name pop up on Twitter and Facebook occasionally liking things on the page, so thank you for chipping in. Tristan Harradine, old Doncaster boy, I think. I think I've raced Tristan a few times. Moose, you've seen him on the AV circuit.
Yeah, he's been on some start lists that I've been in as well,
yep,
in the results pages.
So, yeah, thanks for supporting the show, Tristan. Matthew Blood, a local Ballarat YCW boy.
Yeah, the Blood family is very strong in Ballarat Athletics, and Matty's the young gun of the family, I guess.
Yeah, cool. James Ollie, all the way over in Sweden. He actually knows my auntie pretty well, James, a small world. So we appreciate his support. And Mal D was actually the first person who jumped on the Patreon page last week. And it was funny because we put the show out a day early on Patreon and she'd download the show on the stream there, listened to the show and actually commented on how much she agreed on Julian's Moose on the Loose last week about Michael Shelley. And she was the only person in the world that actually had heard the show. So I found that was quite funny because she got on there early and we stuck to our plan, releasing it a day early. So thanks to those people. Oh, and Julian, one of your mates at the bottom there.
Oh, Wolfie, yeah, big Christian from Ballarat. He's, I don't know. Oh, Wolfgang's his middle name. So big Christian Wolfie, he joins our run group a bit. And I think he did a lot of running against Colas when he was younger, same sort of vintage.
Yeah, so thanks to those people who chipped in at that level last week. We will get to the other people who have chipped in. So people who don't know, we've got three different levels. So we've got the Inside Running Extra Elite level, we've got the Moose on the Loose level, and we've got the Croakers Contributors level. All different prices, all different rewards. We might bang on a bit more about that at the end of the show, what you can expect going forward. But yeah, super stoked to... It was kind of strange. We kind of set it up and we wrote a post about it, and Brad and I had a bit of banter going back and forth how many people would actually chip in, and then I had fun screenshotting my email account for the rest of the day and sending them through to you boys because we were quite surprised just how many people jumped on so quickly. You agree?
Yeah, it's just a nice feeling, I guess, when people feel like what you do has value and they attach some of their own sort of money to show that value, so... Yeah, it was nice to see that happen, and we're really thankful for it.
So what did I say, Brady? We wouldn't get more than 50?
50,
so
yeah.
Where are we at?
Am I winning the bet? Yeah, you still are, but I'll give the listeners a couple more weeks. Some people like don't listen to it so fresh. I think we're at 32 after a week, so we'll be at 50 next week, I'm sure. But yeah, there's no pressure on there, but we hopefully can give the people some decent rewards. And actually, those people actually get a bonus show before they actually listen to this show this week, because this is going to go out a bit later, because we're waiting on a very big dog interview to happen middle of this week. So that's a bit of a taste of what you can expect if you're at that level, and looking forward to doing some bonus content, actually, and just hopefully Moose gets a bit looser, and yeah, we can kind of say what we want in the bonus shows, I think, because it's only going to a select number of people. But anyway, boys, welcome to episode number 26. Big week with that Patreon stuff, but also a big week. Brad's up and about. Julian's kind of a bit down. Bit of an injury niggle. Julian, you want to kick us off with your weekly recap?
Yeah, all right. I'll start then. So I think I ended up last week by my long run I pulled out of. So it was on the Sunday, and I decided that I needed to stop running halfway through my long run because I was running in pain. I have bad plantar fasciitis. So for me, some people get it sore in the arch, others more in the heel. Mine is definitely in the heel. So yeah, I was out running on a long run, got through 20 kilometers, but it was just getting pretty painful. And what I was doing was when my right foot was hitting the deck, instead of it like landing naturally, I was really trying to offload the sore spot, and I was loading up other, I guess, bones a lot more laterally. I was loading, so the outside front half of my foot was getting quite sore during the run. So I thought, this is how people get stress fractures, basically, by putting pressure and load on a bone or an area of the foot that doesn't normally cop it. So I called it quits, just walked back to the house halfway through a long run, but then woke up Monday still determined to to get the workout in that I needed. And it had improved. I'd taken some anti-inflams, and it had definitely improved. So I got out on Monday, ran with Bree, was on the bike. We actually enjoyed 90 minutes down on the rail trail. And then I did 10K afterwards of a tempo run. So I ran 32:20 for the 10K, which was 3:14s. It felt pretty comfortable. I went up some hills and like maybe a hill was a kilometre long, and it was probably a little tough. Like I was probably working too hard for what I should have been, but then it evened out when I went downhill. So I reckon that sort of was probably a slightly harder effort than marathon pace, that 10K tempo at the end. But I don't know, take it. Didn't feel too bad. Didn't have any... Oh, I tried this new nutrition brand called Morton, which is the one that I think Kipchoge uses. Morton, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
You're not meant to be able to get this stuff in Australia, so how'd you get your hands on it?
Yeah, well, Colas had some, and he offered it up, and I just thought I'd like to try it. It's basically the one that I think they have two different versions of it. The one that I had, you mix one scoop of it with 500 or one sachet of it with 500 ml water, and it gives you about 100 grams of carbohydrate for 500 ml. So I imagine how I would do it would be to like halve that into a 250 ml bottle, and you're getting 50 grams of carbohydrate, which is a pretty high concentration. Like compared, if you mix the gel with 250 ml of water, you're getting about 25 to 30 grams. So it's a bit higher concentration. It's not flavored. It's just really sweet because of the sugar. And I should have read up a little bit more about it, but apparently one of the differences is it turns, like when it gets digested, it turns into more of a gel-based texture in your stomach, and it's absorbed a little differently. So it's a bit different to a normal sports gel. It does leave a bit of a funny texture in your mouth, like almost like coats your mouth. So I found I was wanting some water immediately after it just to wash that kind of pasty feel out of my mouth. It didn't give me any stomach aches or anything, which was good, but I didn't really use that much of it either. So
did you go 250? Like, did you half it again?
No, I had one bottle with 500 ml in it, and I just sort of sucked along, breathed his hand it to me when I asked for it, and I probably got through about 300 mil in that 10K. So about 55 grams maybe of carbohydrate in 32 minutes.
Yeah.
Which is a fair bit. And it didn't affect my guts. It was just, I'm not sure I like was wanting more of it at that stage because of how strange the texture was.
So if you did want more, can you get more off Collis? Because haven't you tried as well, Brad? Like, it seems it's really rare, but you blokes are banging on about how you're just sipping it on your Sunday long runs around Canberra and Ballarat.
Well, my...
Where did you get it from? Yeah, this stuff's sketchy here.
Yeah, so last Sunday I ran with a few of Dick Telford's boys, and Hugh had recently been over in the UK, and I think Hugh Williams. So he brought some back, and he had a bottle at like sort of the 20K mark of the long run, and he just said, you know, do you guys want to have a sip of it? And I had the smallest sip because I try and do all my long runs without anything, and it was so sweet. Like, even just like the smallest just taste of it, I'm like, ooh. That was, it didn't really have any flavouring to it. It was just a sweetness. So, I can't really comment on it because one sip doesn't, you know, really constitute a drink, does it? No. But I have tasted it.
Sorry, Julian, go on.
Oh, yeah, well, so, yeah, that was my long run. It's nice to get a long run on a Monday. It pumps your mileage up. Tuesday...
Sorry, just on that session, were you sitting on Bree's wheel when she was on the bike, or were you just she was there for Instagram stories?
Yeah, she's the marketing manager, publicist, so what a girl. Three non-pacing roles. 7K on Tuesday, jogging.
We're still only up to Monday.
Does love a chat.
The Monday, the first person's description of their week. Back to that though. Like, if you've had to cut Sunday's long run because you're battling a bit and had to pull out of it, and then you go bang that session 24 hours later, I know you said it felt better after some anti-inflams, but is that the smartest idea?
Well, it felt better. So you're only as good as how it feels. Like, yeah. It was good enough to do that session on, and I finished feeling fine. And on Tuesday, I was fine as well. And then Wednesday, I was also fine. Mm. So Tuesday, I just jogged. I was busy, late. I didn't get out for a run after work. Wednesday, I went out and did a trail run. Yeah, Anzac Day, kind of got out there, like got to a spot on the Goldfields track, which is like a long trail between Bendigo and Ballarat. And so I went out and explored a bit. Thursday, this is where I reckon it started to get a bit sore. Oh, no. It was still going okay here. So just a few jogs again on Thursday. Friday, went out for... A 20K easy run on the trails. I hurt my back actually on Monday afternoon after this long run. So Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday were all affected by like my back being pretty bad. Just like sacroiliac sort of joint weirdness. Came good on Friday arvo, went out for a run. It was a good run. My foot was feeling okay. But then Saturday morning, did a session around the lake, did a K on, K off workout where the goal was to average 3:10 and then float at about 3:35. And I ran 3:05, then 3:30, 3:06, 3:30, 3:09, 3:25, 3:08, 3:23. So it was a pretty good workout. It wasn't a long workout, but it's hard work changing paces like that. Like, it's a difficult thing for me to do. So I was happy with how it went. But during the cool down, my foot was absolutely killing me, like really, really sore. And I knew there was something wrong there. So Sunday morning, it actually it felt all right Saturday arvo. But then Sunday morning went out and was really loading it differently on a medium long run down the coast. ran with a good group of people. Like, so I kind of wanted to get out. I was probably being a little bit silly at this point, still running on it. Ran down on the Surf Coast Walk trail that runs past Bells Beach, Point Addis. It was really fun run. Pulled up all right, but then I went and saw my friend who's a podiatrist, Luke Madley, and Luke, we'd talked about getting a cortisone injection into the inflamed spot. And so we did that after my long run on Sunday. And if anyone's had a cortisone injection into their foot, I don't think I could get another one. That's how much it hurt. Like, I freaked out a bit. It was really sore. After it happens, it's okay, but like the initial pain of that injection, like I'm still scared thinking about that, having to do that again. But today I had off. It feels like I got a bit of this thing called cortisone flare, I think it's called, and it's when like the cortisone kind of creates a bit of a reaction in the area that it's injected, and like it goes really hot. Like my foot was like on fire, so it was freaking me out a little bit. So we just hung around and sort of waited for an hour or so, and then headed back to Ballarat. It was a bit weird Sunday arvo, but then I had a great sleep last night, and I woke up and I'm like, oh, okay, feel pretty good. But I've been running a bit differently, and I've been walking differently, like on my toes, to try to not step on the sore spot, and it's just been making my front of my foot sore. So it's just a whole lot of mess in my right foot at the moment. But tomorrow I have off, and Wednesday I'll jog. I'll go to run club, do a bit of a run with the gang, and by next weekend I reckon we'll have a pretty clear idea of whether it worked or not, the injection.
20 days to Great Ocean Road Marathon when we record this, I reckon.
Yeah. It's a good time frame to get it, really, because it takes a week to really have an effect, I think, 3 to 5 days. And then you don't want to get it too close, but you also don't want to get it too far away, where if it is effective, it starts to wear off. So it's perfect time to get it.
Does it get to a stage where you second guess going to the start line?
Oh, not at the moment. Like, I think if there was something worse, or I'm not, like, everyone that I've talked to has given me confidence that this is a really helpful thing to do and that I should pull up fine from it. So I'm pretty confident. I think if I had something like Achilles tendonitis, I'd be really worried, and I'd like, or something where rest would help. But with plantar fasciitis, I don't think rest is like the best thing for it. It still likes to be loaded. So having a time off wouldn't really help it too much.
Yeah.
The Moose loves going in as the underdog anyway.
Yeah, I think it's good for him. He's probably putting this on.
It gets him angry.
Well, Brad said he was going to book flights to come down just in case you couldn't get to the start line, just to make sure one of us wins it.
Yeah, I'm not worried. Like, this is the great thing about Great Ocean Road, is that I could have 4 unknown Kenyans who bloody took off from the Com Games or something showing up on this start line, and no one would even know. And that is the great thing about Great Ocean Road. It's like, it's not as hyped as other races, and it's, whether I do well or not, I like the race and I love the road. Like, for me, it's all about Berlin. Like, it's always about Berlin for me. So this is a stepping stone. And to be perfectly honest, like, it's a well-paid race. So if you do well here, it can really set you up if you want to go on a trip later in the year. Like, there's no point in me denying that that's part of the reason why I run it.
Prize money spent before he's even got it, Brad.
Yeah. we know how that went down when he went to Albury.
Yeah.
Fuck off, Michael Roger. Don't send this to him.
All right, Brad, that's an interesting week, Julian. Good luck. We might have to start a Pray for Moose campaign. Sounds all positive. No, sounds like you're not risking anything. Like it's just
I'll be good.
Get the jab, get good. Yeah, you'll win it 4 years in a row. You'll be good.
No, I'll be there healthy. That's the thing. Whoever shows up, it doesn't matter. Like someone else wins it, whatever. I just want to get through it and then start this Berlin campaign.
Mm. All right, Brad. Segue into a guy who hasn't started a Berlin campaign.
No, I won't be doing a Berlin campaign this year. But my week started off, pretty cruisy because I came off a 41K day on the Sunday. So Monday morning was just 45 minutes at 4:20s, and Arvo was 35 minutes at 4:08s with 7 10-second hill sprints afterwards. So I'm sort of just adding one every week or so, probably build up to 8 to 10, I'd say. I won't do any more than that. So that was Monday. Tuesday, got out in the morning for a jog and actually got moving pretty quick, which I normally don't go quite this quick on a morning run. Ran 4:09 sort of first thing, and then went and interviewed Jordan Guzman for the last week's show. And then my main session for that day was 5x1K off a 90-second jog just on the bike path. And that went way better than expected. I sort of went 256, 256, 255, 254, 251 off 90 seconds at, I wasn't a float, so I was running sort of 430s to 440 kilometre pace for that 90 seconds, just sort of out and back on this section of bike path. So, yeah, I was pretty happy with that. I actually put flats on, just practiced the shoes that I was probably going to wear for the Sydney 10, just because I haven't actually worn the real sort of low-profile flats for quite a while. So calves did pull up a little bit sore the next day or two, just from different shoes. But I was pretty happy with that session. Then Wednesday morning, did an hour 45, a bit of climbing involved, sort of 350 metres all up, and got rolling pretty early on to the point that I averaged 4 minute Ks for that hour 45 with sort of the back end being 350s down to 330s, which was a little bit excessive. And I was chatting to my coach at the end of the week that probably pushed the envelope a couple of times, but because I only do two sessions a week, when I'm out there doing it, I always justify it by going, well, it's Wednesday, I'm not going to do a session Thursday, so it doesn't matter if I push this a little bit harder. So that was Wednesday. Then Thursday, just an hour in the morning at 4:20s, and felt pretty rubbish actually, which is probably not surprising after the hard Tuesday arvo and the hard Wednesday. But then felt pretty good Thursday afternoon. Did some gym stuff at home, and I always find if I do gym, then about half an hour later, go out and run, because everything's, all my glutes and everything are activated from gym. I just move so much better. And so I ran 4:05s for that 35 minutes. Just the one session on the Friday, and that was out at Mulligan's over sort of this hilly sort of 10K. And just did that, ended up being a pretty hard session. So I ran 10K in 33:40 odd with sort of 140 metres of elevation. And I reckon they're the best sessions where you're out in the bush. You've got your Garmin on, but you're not getting caught up in splits that much. You're sort of just running to feel, and you're pushing the hills, trying to recover a bit on the downhill. And I reckon it's just really good bang for your buck in terms of just getting strong, and especially over winter. If you're looking at doing cross country type stuff, it's just the perfect session. Saturday morning, just 53 minutes out at Mulligan's again. And because I'm doing Friday afternoon sessions, I absolutely love just sleeping in on a Saturday and just going for an easy run. I guess years and years of training, I'm so used to doing hard sessions on a Saturday. So I've really enjoyed just lazy Saturdays. So it was 4:11s in the morning. And then, Saturday afternoon, I got like just carried away. Ran from home down to Yerribee Pond where I was meeting Viv and our dog was going. And I it was meant to be an easy run, and I ended up averaging like 352s for 9K, and like my last 3 or 4K were like, I think I had a K in there at like 325s or something. And like, while I was doing it, it wasn't obviously max effort, but I was sort of just thinking to myself, why am I doing this? Like, it's an easy run. And yeah, so I was a bit annoyed at myself when I finished that and finished up with 600 meter strides, which felt actually pretty good. That was just getting ready for the Sydney 10, just trying to do some stuff at around 3 minute K pace. So that was Saturday. And then Sunday, was back out at Stromlo again with some of Dick Telford's boys and, yeah, same loop as the week before pretty much. And, yeah, got through 30K at average of 410s, which was, you know, nearly 500 metres of climbing for a week of 166. So I've had three really big weeks of like 160, 183 and 166. So I'm going to back it off this week because I'm back at school and also racing this weekend. So yeah, that was my
solid week. Not much slower than 4:15 in there though, is there? Everything's pretty quick.
Yeah, and that's what I said to my coach as well. I just, because I only do two sessions a week, there's times when I feel like I just, you know, probably run faster than I need to on some of my easy runs, and where I probably noticed it was on Sunday. Like, it was still a good run on Sunday, but my body just felt a little bit on edge. It probably didn't need to be, and it was only because I pushed the Wednesday and pushed Saturday afternoon. But I do want to give a shout out to, there's a physio company here in Canberra who, actually Hugh Williams works there, and, I'm now part of their talented athlete program. So, Kev Laws looked after me on Friday afternoon for a bit of treatment. So, shout out to them.
What are they called? Do you want to maybe say their name?
Oh, Flex Out Physio.
That's good.
Yeah. So,
he's growing up a bit, isn't he, Julian? Sponsors, talented athlete program. Sky's the limit.
Hasn't learned a thing yet. Growing up, but still doesn't listen to his old mate, Sean.
Yeah.
325s on an easy run.
What about the long run where I'm looking here and Hugh Williams, who's one of your competitors, maybe at Sydney 10, would I be right?
Oh, he'll beat me for sure.
And he's gone out and run 427s. Obviously, you've met at the same spot at the same time, and you've gone and run 410s. Like, that's very social.
So I was with, like, the group does splinter a little bit. So he was back with Ben McCronin. So he's a marathoner who's moved down from Queensland. He actually went to Paris, but DNF because he had some hamstring issues, and I think he's still having some hamstring issues. So Hugh basically hung back and ran with him for the day. So Hugh normally runs quicker than that, but he would still normally run probably 4:15s to 4:20s for the run. So, but I was with Reece Edwards, who's also running on Sunday or Saturday, the Sydney 10. So,
we'll get to some predictions at the end.
No, Hugh will beat me for sure. Hugh should run 29:30, I reckon.
What are you going to run?
You'll run 29:45, I reckon. You'll be there.
Anything under 30:30 is, like, the goal. It's going to be, for me, I think it's how comfortable I can be at around that 3 minutes to 3:03s. Like, I haven't done, other than that odd sort of 1K session off 90 seconds recovery, I haven't done a lot of quicker stuff, but I'm hoping that just the volume and the strength that I've been doing, that 3:03s or around that feels pretty comfortable, and then through 5K and then start to try and wind it up a little bit.
Good to watch, good to hear the result next week. I'm going to go quick through my week because we've been banging on for a while here. Easy running Monday, 6K in the morning, 14K in the afternoon. Went to Melbourne to a VO2 test actually on the Tuesday. That was good fun. Down with Steph Gaskell there, and we're part of a study that they're doing at the moment. Blake Hose, your number one employee, he's also a part of the same study.
That's that'll be contentious.
What do you mean contentious?
Contentious. Well, we have a few number one employees.
Oh, dear, sorry. I thought you meant about it being a part of the same study. So that was good. That never done a VO2 before. Have you boys done one?
Yeah, I've done a fair few, just part of AIS studies and things.
Oh, yeah.
I haven't, no.
Have you done the one, Brad, where they kind of like, they keep, the pace goes up first for like the first 15 minutes until it gets like 16K an hour, then they start putting up the elevation on the treadmill?
Yeah, well, the AIS ones we've always done. They try and make it more of a session. So you do you do sub max stuff. So you do 4 minutes at say 16K an hour and have a minute recovery, 4 minutes at 17K, 4 minutes at 18, 4 minutes at 19K, and you pretty much do that until your lactate hits 4 millimole, which is generally around threshold. So then that's like the session part, and then they give you 8 minutes recovery or whatever, and then it starts at 16K an hour, and every 30 seconds it goes up half a kilometre an hour till it hits 20, and then the gradient goes up. So the actual max test only takes like 7 or 8 minutes.
Yeah, right. That's even the one I did. Like, we were going super slow for the first I've just got it in front of me now. We got to 16K an hour after 15 minutes, and then they just started whacking up the incline or the gradient every 3 minutes from then, which is good. So got up to, I think I had Blake, I was stalking his Instagram page just to make sure that I was going to stay on the treadmill longer than he was. And, it got a bit longer, which was good. I got up to, 29 minutes and 20 seconds. When that gradient goes up to 11, it's pretty rough. So I was on there for a couple of minutes at that. Got a score of 81.5, though, which is good. So I was happy with that kind of data. Not sure exactly what that means yet. I might have to start doing some Googling and kind of, check
work. Oh, don't pretend you haven't.
No, I haven't. I've been that busy. But, 81.5.
81 is massive.
That's good, because I used to smoke a few darts back in the day, back when I used to be a skateboarder when I was like 15, 16 before I started running, so I was a bit worried that was going to come back to haunt me, but good to see that the Winnie Blues didn't affect me too much. I used to dress like Brad does now, actually, like the DC hoodie and like tracky pants and go to the skate park, but so that was good. And good test. I enjoyed it. It was just, it's not your VO2 max though, unless you collapse though, is it? Like, it's... You just kind of, I wonder how many more mental things you could put in place to just keep going harder and harder and harder. Like, strange.
Yeah, but your actual numbers won't change because generally the fitter you are, you hit your max, but you can actually then just hold it for a period of time. So, you may have been able to stay on the treadmill for another 30 seconds, but what you often find is just before you fall off the back, your numbers actually drop off. You start to actually decrease the amount that you're taking in. So you would have hit your max.
Yeah, this is right, because they've actually got VO2 peak on this form too, so that would be different to your max, I'm assuming. But yeah, that was good. Good to be down there. Steph knows what she's doing down there, and because Steph's a runner as well, I think you know her, Julian. It's good when you're dealing with those scientists and into nutrition and exercise science and all that kind of stuff that are actually runners as well, because it's like they definitely know what they're talking about. So that was good getting down there. Easy 90 minutes on Anzac Day. It was good having Anzac Day off, not having to get up super early or run in the dark. That was good. Average 4:21, so got moving for me. First time hit 21 in that 90 minutes, 20K, sorry, 8K in the afternoon. Did some hills on my hill loop in Moama Beach times 10. That was a good session. Did about 9K at 3:20K pace, just working the hill and floating the rest. Did that not so long ago after Nobioka. Easy half an hour in the morning and half an hour in the afternoon on the Friday. Then did a big 16K tempo, which was 5K float and 3K hard. Richard wanted me to hit the floats in 3:20s and the hard 3K efforts in 9:15, and then to do that twice. I haven't done this session before. Done bits and pieces of this stuff before. Richard likes throwing these ones in where I kind of float and go hard and float and go hard. But this one was quite hard. I was pretty cooked after that first 3K effort and wasn't sure if I'd be able to keep it going. But when I backed off to that 3:20 pace for that 5K in the middle, it actually felt good, and I felt the heart rate drop a bit, and the data kind of showed me that as well after about 2K back at that pace. And then, ran the middle 3K in 9:10 and then the last 3K at 9:11. So pretty consistent, big session, 16K at 3:13. Had Tim the Bandit Bennett on the bike, and Archie Reed, this young kid up here, was jumping in and out at different stages. And I was pretty cooked after the first half and had to get onto Tim's wheel. I kind of said to him at one stage, just keep this pace going, I'm sitting here for the next 8K. Probably that fine line between, that was definitely a bit of fifth gear going on to hit that session. I think Brad used the gag that I pinned my bib on for that session and the race bib. But it was just good.
was an impressive session. I think what did Julian say? That there's no way I could ever do that in a session or a race.
Mm. Yeah, which he's talking. Yeah, he did that for the last, he did that for the last 16K at Berlin, and now he reckons he can't do that in a session.
Beware of the super session.
Yeah,
the old
super session. But that, like I said to you guys, that message as well, like those conditions are, like conditions were perfect, flat road, guys on bikes, guys jumping in, like that, had the vapor flies on, like that's everything going for me in those sessions. And I think I'm good at kind of getting that rhythm, and 16 to probably 20K is probably my best distance, so probably playing on my strength there, easy 9K in the afternoon. And then I ran with Julian's mate, Dolt. He was up in Echuca Moama for the weekend and sent me a message on Saturday afternoon saying if I was running along. And yeah, I said I'd go for a run with him, and then I asked him what pace he was doing, and the coach had ordered him to run 3:50s to 4 minutes, so much quicker than what I usually run. And after my Saturday session, I was battling to keep up with him big time. He's fit, Julian. He's in good shape, coach.
Yeah, well, there's some stuff he's never done before, a part of his training, and that's one of the things. Like, that's about 95% of what he can probably run a marathon at. So he just takes it down a bit and runs a faster long run.
I took him out of the industrial estate. Did he tell you that?
I haven't spoken to him, actually. I did, just for a little bit. He said he felt pretty good.
Yeah, he felt great. You know when someone pushes up and they get that kind of half step in front of you? And you think they're trying to drop it. I'm like, geez, what is he doing? We're already running at a pretty quick pace here. And then I'd look down at my watch and I was actually just slowing down. He was keeping it honest. And
Serial half-stepper.
Good bloke, actually. I'm surprised he's mates with you. Usually people are friends with people with similar kind of personalities. But, great bloke, actually. And took him out of the industrial estate. And he actually said, I think I'm going to quote him here. He said something like, this is perfect. We need something like this out in Ballarat. Like, he loved it.
Well, makes your GPS look like it's about 10 seconds a K better than it really is.
He told me halfway around it, he goes, this can't be short. There's no way this is short. And I'm like, true. Didn't take him on a real scenic track, though. We ran out to like back blocks out in the vineyards, but didn't get many river views in. But good bloke, and it was good to have some company. But I was working to keep up with him. 3:53 average for 32K, that was too quick. I probably, in hindsight, I think my heart rate was like 148 average as well. Like, that's too big of a weekend. And I felt just on edge, and I probably couldn't enjoy that. I was struggling to talk at some stages because I was just, just working a bit too hard. Then just an easy 20-minute in the afternoon for 183K week, which was nice. Looking forward to some cross-country this weekend down in Melbourne.
Good training.
Let's move on to a bit of news. Not much to report, which is good because we've just spoken for 39 minutes about ourselves. Galen Rupp's running Prague Marathon, though, next weekend, 20 days after Boston. Thoughts?
Probably a good move. Like, what stage did he pull out of Boston?
Pretty late, actually.
Yeah, it was a 32K.
It was around the hills, so it was around the Newton Hill area, which is around 28-32 area,
I think. So let's say 30, but I guess for the pace that they were, like, it sounded like he was having issues with asthma or something, like his breathing. And so the pace that they're actually running at, there probably wouldn't have been a whole heap of like fatigue or muscle breakdown, compared to what he is capable of. So I'm guessing he's pulled up pretty well. But the weather forecast must be good for Prague this weekend.
I think it's meant to be hot. Oh, I was on Let's Run, actually, and you can't take any of the stuff you read there as fact. There were people saying it's going to be warm, but it's probably not. But, it'd be interesting to see what he does there. Hamburg, bit of news there. Hamburg Marathon was last night. You boys were watching it with great interest and annoying me on the Facebook Messenger when I was trying to get to sleep. Tell us about that, Brad.
So they had a bit of a live stream. So I guess just whipping through the results quickly. Hopefully I pronounce these names right. I haven't heard half of these guys. Solomon Dexisa from Ethiopia won the race in 2:06:34. Tadu Abati from Ethiopia was 2:06:54. Ail Abshero from Ethiopia was 2:06:54 as well. So sprint finish there. A bit further down the list, Stephen Kiprotich, the 2012 Olympic marathon champ. He was fifth in 207.57. And Emmanuel Mutai, who's a low 203 marathon man, was ninth in 211.57. And I guess, yeah, there was an Aussie, Jack Colreevy, who represented Australia at the World Champs in London last year. He finished in 30th in 2 hours 31 after going through halfway in 66.39. And I know that we were chatting throughout the, I guess, throughout the race in terms of, you know, 66.39, that's 2:13 and a half pace. And, yeah, like either he was going to have a really good day or it was going to end poorly for him. And I think he got to, was it about 30, from 30 to 35 was a 25-minute 5K, and then recovered a little bit between 35 and 40 to run 20 minutes for that 5K. But, like, I don't know why I get agitated by it, but I just don't know why people go out so hard. Like, if I'm Jack and our PBs, I guess, are similar, like, I look at the guys that are going through 66.39 and they're your Liam Adams. And, like, I don't see myself, I would never see myself as being, you know, in the same ballpark as somebody like Liam. So I don't know, and I don't think Jack's done anything recently. Like, he's, you know, he hasn't run like 13:30 for 5K to, I guess, show that he's in that sort of shape, and maybe one day he will run 2:13 for the marathon. But I don't know, like, I guess I come from a bit more of a conservative background where I think, well, if my PB is 2:18 and a half, like, why not try and run, say, sub 2:16, go through in 68 and, you know, see what happens then. But yeah, it's like, I don't know, I don't think you can beat, like, it's like they're trying to beat physiology. And yeah, I don't know, what do you guys think?
Well, it seems a bit of a waste, doesn't it? Like, you build up for this marathon, spend a lot of time training for it. It's obviously like you're going overseas, and then you go through in 5K, what was it, 15:49. You send a message, and I think, like, I replied back with LOL, because literally read it and chuckled to myself and thought, this is going to be fun to watch. Like, he's either going to breakthrough, like Jeff Hunt, like breakthrough, or we're going to see an amazing capitulation. And it was the latter. So I was excited. Like, there is always that argument. Oh, what happens? Like, if we always limit ourselves by going out easy, we'll never see the next breakthrough or whatever. And
yeah,
it's the way the Japanese do it. They'll run 20 marathons. And they might run one where it comes off and 19 where it doesn't. But that's just how their culture is and the way they do it.
And it's what I was making reference to before. It's like, yes, it's good to have that attitude of, you know, going out hard and trying to be tough. But there's a thing called physiology. And in the marathon, it's like if you go above what you're capable of, you know, in the first, I reckon it all happens in the first 5 to 10K. In that period, yeah, you still feel good, but once you get to 20 to 30, if you've overcooked it just slightly through 5 and 10, it just comes back to get you. And like, I know Jack quite well, and, you know, like, he's obviously super talented and maybe one day can run those times, but you just think, you know, if he's standing on the start line, does he see himself as the same caliber athlete as Liam Adams at this given time? And, like, I don't know. Yeah. So,
well,
it's funny.
I think there's got to be something else going on here, because it's almost like a conscious decision was made at the start. Hey, we're going to go at this pace. So there's, like, it may come down to his coach telling him, this is what you can run. Let's go and see what you can do it.
Yeah.
Let's go through it. This, like, we could be putting not the blame, but we could sort of be suggesting it's Jack's decision to do that, when it may have been Adam Diddick's, his coach, saying you should go out at this pace.
But I guess as well, like, people could have potentially said the same thing about my late BWA run, in that, you know, I went through half way quicker than, you know, what my current PB was. Like, you know, my PB was 2:24, and I was going at sub 2:20 pace through halfway. So, you could argue the same thing, that, you know, why is he going through halfway so quick?
No, but you just had to listen to the podcast to know your current training. That's different.
Does it annoy you as well? And this is what annoys me a little bit. And I got in a bit of an argument.
Is this moose on the loose early? Is this what's happening here?
Sure.
I feel like
Brad's kicked you off a bit. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't. I'm happy to share it with you this week, Brad. But I got in a semi-argument with another message group that I have going on, where they were suggesting that this was a great ambitious move by Jack. Oh, it's so good to see. He's so confident. He's a really ambitious guy. And I'm like, really? Like, oh, and he's so brave. And I'm looking at it going, is that brave? Like, is that what we call brave? A bloke going out who's seriously overestimated his ability to run the marathon that fast? Like, for me, like, and I saw it on Twitter a bit. Oh, Athletics Australia, such a gutsy run by Jack. In my head, I'm going, no, like, this was a really poorly executed race. I look like we all have bad races, and this may have been just you might have gut issues, you might have something go on, but it seemed like it was like that half marathon was close to what he could run his fastest half marathon in at the moment, and not too different from it, the way that the blow up occurred after that. So was it brave, or was it poorly planned, or was it actually planned really well but poorly executed? Like, we just don't know, but we always pay it as a brave move.
Gutsy, yeah. It's a lot in that for the listeners, though, thinking about your half marathon splits for your upcoming marathons. Just bringing it back, talking about listener question, Julian, this one's right up your alley. Do you want to read it out? Because I'm hoping you've got some good answers, because this, I don't want to play favourites, but could be the best, most, not best, maybe the most interesting listener question we've had come in so far.
Yeah, I agree. I like it.
The most thought-provoking.
Yeah, and I was like, we saw this last week, and I'd been meaning to actually give it some thought during the week, but haven't, and then got back on here tonight and thought and read it. So please discuss what, if any, key developments in knowledge, apart from drugs, have occurred in the past 50 years or so since Arthur Lydiard self-experimented to arrive at his basic ingredients for training and racing. And there is like a Lydiard-type formula that how he used to structure athletes' training cycles, where he would do a lot of base building. Then he would go through a strength phase where, like, you would do bounding type movements up hills, like circuit work almost on a hill. Then they would go into like a, I think it was a speed or a time trial phase, where they ran a lot of like track work, like time trial races, and then they would do their race season. He's sort of known for high mileage, Lydiard. Like, that's what he had. He had Peter Snell, the 800-meter runner, running like 32 kilometers over the, what is it? Freaking.
Yeah, it starts with W.
Yeah, Wanakua or something, hills.
Jeez, New Zealand listeners aren't happy with that.
Yeah, I've always read it, and I recognize the word, but I've never pronounced it.
Yeah, so I reckon I could spell it for you, but I don't have a clue.
I love the reading about those dudes run that on a Sunday, and they, like, it sounds a bit of a race, really, because they come back smashed. The question was, what has developed since then in, I guess, knowledge? Like, what do we know now that Lydia didn't know, and what are we doing differently?
From Alan Peacock. It's a good one.
Yep.
So other than drugs, what do we do, wise man?
Well, immediately, like, the way that I look at it is that there's still lots of different training philosophies out there that are all different from each other. So it's hard to be like, oh, there's this one consistent thing, like, between all training now that we do that we didn't used to do. Or there's one thing now that we don't do that Lydiard did. But so I look at it, like, if we look at, say, the the Renato Canova sort of way of training. Like, how does he do things differently? And there's lots of good discussion out there about how much Lydiard's influenced that sort of philosophy. And that said, a lot of Lydiard's sort of ideas, theories, philosophies got proven through later on through science and testing that they actually did have merit to them. But so, for instance, Canova, he will do a lot more specific work. So paces correlating more to your race goals, whereas Lydiard seemed to do effort-based time trials. And there's still like discrepancy as to what was an effort. So he would prescribe something like three-quarter effort, and that's really hard to work out what that is. Like, is it three-quarter effort as it says, or is it three-quarters of the pace that you want to run at? And it's very hard to know what it actually meant. Not a lot of like splits back then were taken of their workouts, I don't think, or they haven't been put into the books anyway. So specific zones, like for instance, a marathoner going out and doing long intervals at the marathon pace, or doing speed work that's like with long recoveries, that sort of work. I guess if we're talking about specific interval training, then there's also the 1%ers that get involved now that maybe weren't specifically like nutrition, weight training, emphasizing the importance of recovery. Like, it seemed there was a lot of hard running going on back then. They're the things that came to mind instantly for me.
I was just glad that you read that out and answered it, because I think you were the overqualified one to answer that one, because you read all these books too. Like, you know, I've seen the photos of your book collection. You're all over this kind of content.
Well, I do, and I especially like the New Zealand, the books on the New Zealanders, like John Walker. He wasn't a Lydiard guy as such, but he did run that long run a few times. And Peter Snell, Murray Hallberg, I think it was Alan Davies maybe, but there's a Bill Bailey. The guys, that they could basically run anything from a mile to a marathon. And it was just amazing back then when Lydiard had him do this training. Like, the fact that Peter Snell, as an 800-meter runner, was going out and running 100-mile weeks, week in, week out, with 32k hilly hard long run in the middle of it. Like, the faith they had in Lydiard. Well, Snell and him had a little bit of disagreement later on in Snell's career, but early on, like, they just like were so committed and loyal and dedicated, trusting of this man, that it, no matter what they did, like, the buy-in or the love for that program and the trust they had was all that was kind of required to make things work. Obviously, the super aerobic type development over there, really strong runners. But Peter Snell, he also had the speed.
Yeah, and a lot can be said about that tribe and kind of group effect as well. Like, that's another thing they also did well and probably identified early that it works.
Definitely.
Yeah, we have a name. Yeah. Yep, Brad.
I'll just add, well, yeah, before I saw Julian's response, the two comments that I would have had was, I guess, the marathon-specific type sessions. That's probably one change to what Lydiard has, so the Canova stuff, and probably the studies around nutrition and probably race day nutrition in terms of, you know, grams of carbs per hour or that sort of thing, or, you know, carb loading, how many grams of carbs per kilo of body weight. But the thing I find really fascinating is that, you know, if you followed Lydiard's program even now, like, you know, it's what, 50, 60 years old, like, it's 90% there. Like, it's going to get you fit for, as Julian said, anything from 15 or anything from 800 up to the marathon. There's just a couple of, probably depending on the type of person you are, where you just tinker it a little bit, where you, if you're training for a marathon, you might be better off adding, you know, some of those marathon specific sessions. But everything that he prescribed in terms of just regular long runs, and especially over hilly terrains, and having that sort of two main peaks a year, it all holds true even now, really. So there's not a lot that needs to be really tinkered with.
Good answer.
Yeah, and it's fun. Like, it's what I like. Like, I read the book and go, oh, this is fun. Like, this is how I want to train.
Yeah.
Some people, like, I look at their programs and go, oh, God, like, this doesn't suit what I want to do as a runner. Like, I don't want to, like, I want to get in the bush and pound out some hilly long runs. I don't want to do, like, masses of intervals or whatever.
I also, the other thing that you probably need to take notice of Lydiard's training, and I don't know the history, but I'm guessing that a lot of his athletes were able to be consistent for a very long time and not miss training. So obviously he had that balance in there, although somehow they were just hard enough that they didn't get injured. But it doesn't matter what program you're doing. I think the key is the consistency. And it seems like that those guys managed to string together week after week after week of, you know, decent 100 mile weeks, and that's probably what led to their great racing, more so than what they're doing on each individual day.
Yeah, definitely. Consistency is always always the key.
Yep,
there is nothing better than it.
Alrighty, I think Alan be quite satisfied with that answer. Well done, boys. I didn't do much there, but I knew you'd take that one. Moose on the Loose has already happened. Let's wrap this up. What's happening this week? Brad, you're racing 10K?
Yeah, so just a lightish week this week. I'll just do a few, maybe 1Ks on Wednesday, and then, yeah, head up Friday after work and race Saturday, and then come straight back after the race. So, yeah, looking forward to it. I haven't raced a hard 10K on the road for a couple of years, and I'm interested to see, and I haven't run one as sort of a marathoner. I've always run it training as a 10K runner. So it'll be interesting to see how I go as more of, I guess, a marathon type program. So, yeah, excited.
That's it. Julian, two more days off and then you're back on?
Yeah. Basically, just assess after that.
Yep. I'm same thing, a bit lighter, same as you, Brad. 8K cross country. Hopefully I go a bit better than 2 weeks ago. Do you know who's running, Julian? Any big dogs walking around?
I don't know. I'm not in the scene, mate.
Hey, you are the big dog. What are you talking about?
No, I don't know what I might still run. Still might see me
there. Really? Oh.
Yeah.
Righty-ho, that'd be good.
I got to organise a day off work, so I got to make use of it.
I actually thought I might have had one off where I didn't have to worry about you for once in a race. It's a bit of pressure off from trying to beat you.
I'm going to be fresh as well.
Fresh as.
I will have done very little this week.
All right, thanks for that. Thanks to the Patreon supporters. Thanks to the people who dropped in some one-off payments on the PayPal account, Richard Parisom and Suzanne Barry. Appreciate your contributions, that word is. Jake Robertson interview. Brad, haven't done it yet. I'm getting a bit nervous about this. Like, it's the first real, real current big dog we're going to be interviewing. How are you feeling?
Yeah, I've still got to do a little bit of prep for it, and I'm waiting to try and tee up a time with him, but I'm really excited because there's just so many ways the conversation could go, and there's just so much to talk about. And based on the conversation I had with him in Lake Biwa, he seems like a really easy guy to talk to, and seems to open up easily. So, yeah, looking forward to it.
Yeah, I'm going to email you through a few questions. I've got a few things I want to know as well. Yeah, very exciting stuff. Make it go. Do a long one. Get as much out of him as possible, I reckon. None of these 25-minute quick chats, get moving.
Yeah, I know he's just arrived in New Zealand, so I hope, yeah, and as I said, I've messaged him, so it's just a matter of us trying to lock in a time now.
Beautiful. Enjoy this chat then. Jake Robertson, thanks for tuning in. See you again next week. Bye-bye. Won't you come and take a walk in my shoes and tell me if you take my place? Hey, mate.
Hey.
How you going?
Yeah, I'm all right.
How's
a little bit rushed?
Yeah, how's the jet lag?
Pretty bad, actually. I think being in off-season doesn't help.
Yeah. So it was worse than when you came down for Comm Games?
Yeah, much worse.
Yeah. And what are you in New Zealand for? Is this for your wedding?
Yeah, that and other things. I mean, just everything and anything I can do. You know, today I was at Westlake Boys School doing
cool.
some extra motivation stuff, which is cool.
Yeah, very good. And I guess, how many times have you been back to New Zealand in the last 11 years?
I think this is number 4 or 5.
Wow, okay, yeah.
And it's that irregular.
Yeah, and so other than family, what do you miss the most about it?
I miss the lifestyle. Like, every time I come back here, I mean, things in Africa sometimes are, like, so hard, and just simple everyday things become more difficult. So it's, yeah, the more I come back here, the more I miss it. But I know if I was to be here, I wouldn't be as good a runner, you know.
Yeah.
And,
So obviously, a lot of your, I guess, last 11 years in Kenya has been pretty well documented, and we will get to some of that. But I might actually touch on what you've been able to achieve so far this year, because it's pretty incredible, actually. You must be pretty happy with the start of the year.
Yeah, I mean, last year I finished on kind of a negative because I missed Fukuoka. But I knew the shape hadn't gone anywhere, so it was all about getting into the races I needed to unleash. And
yep.
I got into mostly the races I wanted to get into, and I just managed to unleash on everything I wanted to. So
yeah, I might actually just give our listeners just a quick rundown of what you've actually managed to achieve this year. So January, you won the Houston Half Marathon in 60.01 against a pretty stacked field. Then in March, headed to Lake Biwa, and that's where I met you for the first time, and that was your debut. Ran 2:08.26, which took about 30 seconds off the New Zealand record, which was held by Rod Dixon, and it was, what, 25 years old? So 35 years. So, you know, that's no mean feat. And then to be able to back up 4 weeks later, run 27:28 on the roads in New Orleans to equal your brother Zane's national road 10K record. And then a couple of weeks later, finish fifth at the Comm Games in another New Zealand record in 27:30. So you're keeping the people at Athletics New Zealand busy with rewriting the record books. Of those races, is there one that stands out for you that you're most proud of?
Not in particular, because I felt like I had so much more in the marathon to give. But the other ones stand up with the marathon one, because I felt that way about it. And
yeah.
I feel like I've got a lot more to give on the track now as well. So
yeah,
it's going to be an interesting next couple of years mixing the marathon and 10K on the track. So
yeah, yeah. So we might touch a little bit on your Lake Biwa experience. So when did you commit to Lake Biwa, and why did you choose Lake Biwa?
I felt bad about missing the marathon in December in Fukuoka, which was Japan. So I really wanted to do my debut in Japan, and Tokyo's budget was out, so they didn't make an offer, and Lake Biwa came through with a pretty good one, which made an obvious choice. But also, yeah, Lake Biwa, it's a pretty good race, but it's not a marathon major, which it's a really good race to debut in and
yeah.
Get a good feel for the racing of how the marathon goes. And, that's where I made my decision.
Yeah, and how long was your prep for Biwa?
Well, like I said, the preparation that I did for Fukuoka hadn't dissolved with, 10 days of injury.
Yeah.
So that all being said, I was already fit in December, ready to go, but had to kind of hold on and then, run run through the half marathon in Houston as training and, use everything towards Lake Biwa. And, I actually think I probably was in better shape for Houston in the half than I was for Lake Biwa. Yeah.
Is that just because you're trying to hold that fitness for too long?
Yeah, that was one reason. And when you do that, you're really on edge for a lot longer. So you risk a little, you know, a niggle here or there and, you know, sickness or something like this. So, yeah, mainly because I was trying to hold on to that top level shape.
And a lot of our listeners wouldn't realize that you're actually self-coached. So could I guess you give us an idea of in the lead up to both Fukuoka and Lake Biwa, what a standard week would look like for you?
Yeah, a standard week would be Monday would be usually just a break-in day for the weekend. Yeah, just a 1-hour 10 run with some drills or strides and get ready. And then Tuesday would be 1 hour with you know, some sprints or something to get ready for Wednesday's workout. Wednesday, Monday would have gym session as well. But Wednesday would be my hard workout, and this would be either track, a fartlek session, or a continuous interval session on the road, depending on the week, on how hard and how much volume, the intensity, everything. But Wednesday and Saturday are my workout days.
And so would you be able to give us a rough idea of, say, what a maybe a standard track session would be, what a standard fartlek session would be?
Yeah, fartlek, we would do things like 20 times 2 on, 2 minutes on, 1 minute off. And usually the 1 minute off is still moving around 3:40 to 4 minutes jogging pace per K.
Yeah, and that's at altitude as well. So
Yeah, that's altitude. Track session, we'll do things like 15 times 1K. Paces, usually we do try and do that session descending primarily because we don't want to blow up,
so we
start around 255, 258 sometimes, and then get down pretty quickly towards 250 and then into the 240s.
And what sort of recovery do you have off those 1Ks?
Usually around 2 minutes.
Yep. Do you find at altitude you generally do have slightly more recovery between reps than you would at sea level?
I haven't really thought about that, but I guess so, because always at sea level you recover faster. And obviously it's just become routine up there that 2 minutes is like, that's the thing. No matter what the distance of repetition, it's always 2 minutes.
Yeah.
If it's fartlek, it's 1 minute.
Yeah, which is a good point, because I think a lot of Westerners sort of get used to doing everything off really short recovery. And I think there's often value in just taking that little extra 30 seconds to a minute to get a little bit more out of the reps themselves.
Yeah. And our continuous effort intervals is probably the hardest type of workout we have, which is you have a 1K recovery. Let's say we are doing 3K intervals times 6, but there's 1K recovery in between.
Yep.
We're still moving at 3:30 pace to even sometimes a 3:10 pace.
Yeah.
So that's it's barely recovery. But
what's that? It must be close to what, a 25-kilometer sort of workout.
Yeah. And I've crossed the half marathon in a 64, I think, in training with that type of a session. So
yeah,
it's pretty intense.
And so that's Wednesday. So then Thursday is obviously a easier day.
Yeah, Thursday and Friday are pretty much scheduled the same as Monday and Tuesday, with a gym session on then the Friday is getting pretty much ready for Saturday, which is usually the long run, which is 30 and 40K alternating weeks.
So is that, so 1 week's 30 and 1 week's 40, did you say?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Usually,
yeah.
A normal week.
And are they always quick, or are they generally conversational pace?
Yeah, they're always quick. Yeah, they're always, it's planned like a workout, so
yeah,
it's quite intense. We're able to chat, but nobody really wants to, because you don't know what's going to happen 20 or 30K into it.
So I guess the Africans are always known to start off runs pretty slow. So with those long runs, do you start off the first couple of kilometres pretty slow and then build into it from there, or it's from the gun?
Well, yeah, our group, the way I've done it is like some of the other groups, we have a little bit of a warm-up before it, like just 5 or 10 minutes, just, you know, make sure your metabolism's active and you're nice and warm, because starting at a 340k pace is not so easy, even though we do start slower, because 340, our starting pace, and we're finishing, you know, sometimes below 3 minutes. So it's a difference.
And so then, so you only run once a day?
Yeah, a lot of the time it's once a day with alternative gym in the evening or a stretching session.
I found
that works for me very well.
Yeah, okay, because that's quite interesting, because I know most marathoners that I know generally are twice a day, and most of the African groups train once a day, or some of them are twice.
Yeah, most of them are once a day on their easy days, and only twice a day on their hard days. But sorry, I left that out. If we do a fartlek or a track session, we will train twice. We'll go for evening jogging, which is only about 8 or 9K.
Yeah, and is that super super slow, or you still get moving on those?
Usually we're running through the forest, so it's pretty hard to get going. But I mean 4:30s we'll get down to. Yeah.
Okay, and then Sunday's rest day.
Yeah, Sundays most of the time is rest, unless we've had bad weather and decided to rest during the week a day, then Sunday is rest.
Yeah, and so what would have been your biggest volume week in the lead up to, I guess, both Fukuoka and Biwa?
Yeah, this is a surprising thing I keep telling people. I only hit around 150, and that's kilometres.
Yeah, right.
For my biggest week. And I think that's a major reason why I was able to back up so well with the 10K and marathon being so close, because the intensity of my sessions was so high, the volume obviously wasn't.
Yeah.
And helped me keep a higher pace in training and in my sessions.
And I guess with that 150, as you said, the intensity's high, but also the terrain that you're running on, do you run over a lot of hills?
Yeah, most places are hilly. We try and go to a place for the long runs that have less hills, but I still hear that it's considered quite hilly for foreigners when they come through. So
I mean
everywhere's got hills.
And then, so like what I've been amazed with was how well you ran your 10Ks off the marathon. And did you do anything different? So going from training for a half or a 10K, which you probably had been doing the last few years, was there anything different that you did to get yourself like marathon fit?
Yeah, once I decided that I was going to do my debut in marathon, I had to start running 40K long runs.
Yeah.
That was a must.
Yep.
Just to, you know, see, by 40K long runs, you can actually see and get a feel for if your body is responding to it, and you kind of grow confidence off that, because it's a really, like, it's a specific type of workout that, you know, you get a different feeling past 38K, and you really can feel if you're going to be good at this or not.
I agree. And so you just do the one long, so you don't do like a midweek long run?
No, everything's around an hour 10. It would be a random week decision just to do a bit of a longer week with less intensity, and we'll put an hour 20 in there midweek or something.
I remember you telling me in Biwa, one of your key sessions, which you thought was actually probably better than your race in Biwa, was it a 40-kilometer tempo that you did in the lead-up?
Yeah, it was a 40K long run. And,
can you tell the listeners sort of what pace, or what you ran that 40K at altitude?
Yeah, I ran 2:13:58, if I remember right.
Yeah, on dirt roads?
Yeah, that's dirt roads with hills at about 2,400 meters altitude. And the only person in recent time that I knew had hit that around that time was Kipchoge.
Yeah.
So yeah. I knew after that one, you know, that I was on for it.
So the Lake Biwa experience in itself, because it was your debut, how did you decide what sort of pace you wanted to run at, like knowing it was your first one? What did you think you were capable of going into it?
Yeah, I was. I thought I was capable of a course record, which the course record was at 2:06:13. So I thought I was capable of 2:05.
Yep.
What I decided to go at was the race pace that was set. So whatever the meet director was setting up with the pacemakers, and I was just aiming to win it.
Yep.
Any extra time that I hit was going to be a bonus.
Because they said about, it was just under 64, wasn't it, through half?
Yeah, so.
Yeah, which is hard to run. Up. Yeah, it's hard to run, I guess, you know, 205, 206 off that, isn't it, first half?
Yeah, especially with the conditions the way they were, I felt like it may have taxed me a little bit in the later stages. I'm not sure what went on, but,
yeah.
You know, that's a marathon.
yeah, definitely. Like, there's so much. We look at, you know, look at Boston recently, and then you look at the Commonwealth Games marathon, and, the weather is one thing you can't control. So do you think that, so you think the weather definitely played a part in Biwa? Because, like, I guess I found it, coming from a Canberra summer where we've had 35 degrees, it was definitely warmer than ideal for a marathon, but I didn't find it too hot. What were your thoughts on it?
Yeah, so obviously, it wasn't too hot for you, but we do all our hard sessions in the morning, which is actually pretty cold, and I was planning on Japan being quite brisk, maybe 7 to 9 degrees, you know, at the warmest.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing, actually. Yep.
Yeah, we were prepared for cold weather. I came with gloves and arm warmers, you know, in case of it being cold, like zero. And, so mainly I wasn't prepared for 20 degrees or whatever it was. You can't control it, so you just know everyone's dealing with the same conditions.
Yeah. Just a quick question. The first time I saw you was actually in the race hotel. I think it was breakfast the morning before the race, and I was standing at the coffee machine and I was just looking down at the floor, and next thing I know, this pair of shoes turn up, and they're the Vaporfly 4%ers. And I'm like, Who's wearing 4%ers to breakfast? Either they're one of the big dogs, or they're just like a cash. They've just got too much money. So are they a casual shoe for you, or you're actually just wearing them in for the next day?
Yeah, they were brand new the night before, so I was wearing them around for the breakfast, just to walk in them and get a feel for them and make sure they're fitting, and yeah.
That's pretty cool. Like, oh, geez, here he is. I wonder how many of these pairs of 4%ers he's got stockpiled if he can just wear them to breakfast.
No, definitely not, but those were brand new.
Okay, so that's Biwa, and then you told me, you had a couple of 10K races coming up, including the Commonwealth Games. How long did it take you to recover after the marathon, and what did you do between the marathon and the 10Ks?
Yeah, I had 3 days off straight away after the marathon. I was, obviously pretty toasted.
Yeah,
smoked, and like the travel, yeah. The travel as well, traveling back afterwards, I was pretty tired after that, arrived later in Kenya, so missed another day. And, then I got back to jogging. First day I felt terrible, which was only 40 minutes.
Yep.
And then the next day was an hour. And I ran this for another week, just an hour. Some days were 40 minutes, some days were an hour. I knew that if I could just jog, that I wasn't going to lose my fitness. It was just about recovering for the 10K. So I didn't really have any plans of when my first workout would be. But yeah, I recovered. It was about 12 days after the marathon I did my first session.
Yeah. And were you surprised with the times that you were running for the 10K coming off marathon training? Or do you think that having done those 40K long runs and having that strength from the marathon, it's actually a good way to train for a 10K?
I think it's a good way for me.
Yeah.
I think I could have done more specific work, especially for the track. I think I can, you know, run 26 for the 10K on the track, 26 minutes, but, you know, that's still to show. And, yeah, I mean, the next coming years, maybe I'll do more specifics and more speed for the track for the 10K. But, yeah, obviously for the road, the way I ran that road race as well, really the marathon training helped me for that.
Yeah.
You know, because I went gun to tape.
Yeah.
And, but, yeah, I wasn't surprised with the time. I was expecting it because the sessions I did in Kenya before, even after the marathon, went so well that I was like, wow, I feel great here.
Yeah. And did they change to what you had been doing before the marathon? So that, were they a little bit shorter and sharper, or were you still doing those sort of longer interval sessions?
Yeah, no, it was a little bit shorter reps because I was feeling a little bit like tired and, you know, tired mentally, I'd say.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, I need to pick up, and holding it together over 600s will be a little bit easier than K's.
Yeah, yep.
To hold the pace for 10K. So I held it together and did one of the best sessions of my life for the. It was, I think it was 10 times 600,
yep.
If I remember right. Yeah. So we were supposed to do 12, but the quality was so high, I was like, nah, guys, we're doing two more and that's enough.
And that was on the track?
No, we were doing it on the road. We're supposed to do track, but it rained. So
yep.
We actually hit the tarmac and did a road session, which probably was a good thing.
And so what sort of times were you hitting for those 600s?
It was mostly around, I had a lot of 135s, I think.
Wow, yeah. And off what, 2 minutes?
Yeah.
Yeah.
2 minutes. No, I think because we did it on the road, we had less recovery.
Yeah, okay. Then just quickly on your Commonwealth Games experience, because I know a lot of our listeners will have watched the race, and you looked super strong throughout most of the race, and then you obviously went to the front in the later stages, and what were you thinking at that point? Did you think you had a chance to win, or you were just trying to put a bit of pressure on them?
Yeah, to be honest, I knew the threat was Mo and Mohamed and Cheptegei, the Ugandan. Yeah. Those two are just, you know, they're track stars. They're a class apart, and I believe that they're going to be, you know, the main guys taking over Mo Farah's role. Yeah, I was hoping that I'd be in the mix to get a medal, but to upset those two was going to be tough. When I hit the front, I knew I was going to hit the front at some point in the race and really make a push. Yeah, I didn't know how long or when I was going to do it. I just was feeling out the race and feeling how it was going to be.
Yeah,
it may have been a lot sooner if the pace was slow, but obviously I was pretty happy with the way it went out. So.
Yeah, yeah. But I guess any time you're running a PB at a major championships, it's a good achievement, and especially you know, they wouldn't have been ideal 10K conditions either on the Gold Coast.
Yeah, not really. But yeah, again, you switch all those things off, and you just like focus on what you got to do. And obviously, by Commonwealth Games, I was even more mentally tired. So day by day, it was a strain just holding it together.
Yeah. Because you've done a lot of travel too in those few weeks. You know, you'd been to Japan, back home, to the US, and then, or I guess you flew to a couple of locations in the US, then to Australia. So it does take its toll, doesn't it?
Yeah, really. And main things like believing in yourself. Like days before the race, I was completely out of it, saying, "Oh no, I don't believe in myself anymore. I felt terrible today."
Yeah,
but then. It's all like you show up to, you know, you wake up the morning of the race and you're like, nah, what I promised to myself, you know, this, I have to feel good today. No negativity, yeah. You know, and it's just all positives. You're putting that in your head like as much as you can every day. And then you just, yeah, you show up amped up and do what you can.
And it's sort of a good segue into, because I do want to get back into your early days in Kenya, but do you think that that positive self-talk and that self-belief is one of the major things that you've learnt in your time in Kenya?
Definitely, definitely. You know, the Kenyans used to, in my early days, they used to ask me, like, what are you training for? Because, you know, you're not very good right now. I was like, you know, I'm 18 years old.
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, I'm not training for now. I'm training for 4 years from now. And they're like, uh-huh, yeah, all right.
Which is a very mature outlook, because most 18-year-old distance runners that I know don't have the patience, and they want results in, you know, 2 weeks' time, not 10 years' time. So it's a pretty mature outlook to have, which brings me back to early days. Do you actually remember the day that you and Zane made that decision in New Zealand that, yep, let's do this, let's go and book our airfare?
Yeah, I remember the day, and I think I was still in Japan.
Oh, okay. Well, so what were you doing? What were you doing in Japan?
It was the World Cross in Japan.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, I was chatting with the Kenyans, and that's when I heard the World Cross Country was in Mombasa the next year, which is in Kenya.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, okay, well, I'm going to Kenya anyway. And it was like, it was a day or two after that I was like, well, I'm definitely going to do some altitude training before this. Perfect excuse to get there.
Mm, yep.
So that's when I made up my mind that I was going, regardless of how I was going to get the cash. So
yeah. And then I'm sure a lot of our listeners know the, I guess, the hardships that you went through in terms of basically having one room with a mattress and eating jam sandwiches and catching malaria. With that hardship, how long do you reckon it lasted before you actually said to yourself, you know what, I've actually made the right decision here?
Yeah, I think we never doubted that we hadn't made the right decision.
Even on your deathbed when you've got malaria, you weren't questioning it then?
Yeah, those times are very, very hard to say. Obviously, when you're that ill and you're almost dying, I mean, the only thing that kept us, like, positive at the time was, like, at least we tried. You know, that was the thing. Like, we'd done all we could. We went and we tried our best. So even if we were to die right there and then, we couldn't have tried any better, with the way we went. So
yeah,
that's what kept us going at that point.
And as you said, when you went there, you're quite young, 17, 18. How did your training, or if you look back at the training that you were doing in Kenya then compared to now, how did that change? And who was anybody coaching you initially, or you were just following whoever was in the camp that you were with?
Yeah, usually we're following whoever was leading the group. So if it was Shaheen, we were just joining Shaheen, and you know, Shaheen quite quickly would give us pointers saying, don't join me every day because what works for me won't work for you.
Yeah. And so
obviously training at that level with a world record holder, he's pumping us every day. Like,
yeah.
So he cared for us and pointed us in the right direction. Patrick Sang, training with Kipchoge, Eliud Kipchoge's coach, for a while, that was really that was really insightful for a year in 2010.
Yeah,
I learned a lot from him. I picked up a lot of things from here and there.
Yeah, which was going to be one of my questions. Now that you're a coach yourself, or you coach yourself, but you also coach athletes, who's probably been your greatest influence, or who have you taken the most from? Because you've probably come across Canova as well. And various other coaches. So is there one particular coach that you've sort of looked at and gone, yeah, I like what he does?
Yeah, I learned a lot from Patrick Sang, which is Kipchoge's coach.
Yeah.
The main thing I could say I learned from him is that he thinks athletes need help doing less rather than more. And
yeah.
And that's a great example of it, because like all athletes want to do is more and harder, and you know they're pushing themselves to the limit. But to limit an athlete and say no, this is the pace and this is what you do, it's perfect.
It's so well said, which I guess comes back to you running a marathon off 150 kilometres a week. You know, in a way, most people would look at that and say, he's not doing enough. But, you know, you've run 208 on debut, which is a pretty good achievement.
And also, I was really worried to tell people about that because they were going to say, you haven't done enough. But with the feeling in the body and the 40Ks and the sessions I was putting together, I knew I had. So.
It's funny you say that about Patrick Sang as well, in terms of getting people to do less and probably taking easy days easier. I don't know if you know or heard of Sean Crichton. He's the Australian steeplechase record holder.
I have heard of him, yeah.
Yeah, so they were around the same era, and they used to actually compete against each other, and Sean used to train with Patrick, and Sean's renowned for running his easy days really easy, and he's been a previous guest on our show, and he said he thought he ran slow on his recovery days, but Patrick took it to a completely new level, and so Patrick definitely saw the importance on recovery. His athletes still like that?
There's definitely a difference within the track runners and the marathon runners. The marathoners do tend to get up to pace, but we start really slow on our easy days. And yeah, once we get rolling, we do roll out 4 minutes per K and stuff like that. But yeah, the track runners, wow, their easy days sometimes, it's 5 minutes per K the whole run.
Yeah, so. Yeah, sure. Getting back to those early days, so at what point did you start to, so how long had you been over there where you actually started to see this, I guess, significant improvements? Or was there a turning point where you went, wow, I'm at a completely new level here? Was it 1 year, 2 years?
It was probably 4 years in.
Okay, so what did that, 2011, 2012? So do you remember a significant race or some sort of session where you just went, wow, this is, I would have never done this if I stayed home?
Yeah, it was probably a random road race through a castle when I actually challenged Kipchoge and beat Shaheen.
Where was that?
There was Bosnia. Yeah, one of those countries on its side.
Yeah.
I think it was Bosnia. It was just a 4 mile road race. But yeah, to be within 6 seconds of Kipchoge, who had just won the silver in the Commonwealth Games in Delhi, and, beating Shaheen there. And I wasn't selected, although I'd filled out application forms and I'd run, the qualifying time. So the state that I should have been in Delhi was when I was like, well, hopefully I won't miss Worlds the next year, and I didn't.
Yeah, so this is Athletics New Zealand didn't select you?
Yeah, which at the time they had a poor organisation. Luckily, the next year they got a new CEO, which is still the CEO today, and he does a great job.
Yeah, one of the questions I had was the support that you've received from Athletics New Zealand, like especially in those early days. Did people from Athletics New Zealand know that you were actually over in Kenya in those early years?
Yeah, they did. And unfortunately, after Mombasa, they stopped caring and they considered me and Zane arrogant for being different or trying something new.
Yeah.
And because we had no way of proving any fitness to them, like within their sight range, they wouldn't select us for the junior events, even though we qualified for the World Junior Track Championships in Poland. And, we missed our junior career because of, poor organization and selection policy.
Oh, you're making up for it now.
Yeah.
And so with the you went over there, you didn't have any sponsors, and I remember seeing footage of, was it both of you that cut the logos out of your singlets, or was that Zane?
It was Zane at that time. So yeah, I just had a fully blank one. So.
Yeah. And so what was the turning point with getting sponsorship as well? Because those, you would have been doing it pretty tough early on, I'd imagine.
Yeah, no, our early days in Kenya, we got everything stolen by the guys in the camp. one by one until we realized, and then we had only one pair of training, you know, one tracksuit, one pair of training shoes, bare minimum to get by. And then, you know, there's some shops in Eldoret, so, you know, you'd have jam sandwiches to save up that extra buck so you can eventually buy a pair of secondhand training shoes or something.
And so then, so you're training in Kenya, you're doing, I'd imagine, so outside of training, you're doing the occasional cross-country race over there as well?
Yeah, I mean, we'd get fully absorbed and fully involved in all the races. There was track series, there was a cross-country series, and we'd fit that in like training and go as hard as we could in them, you know.
And then to get onto the international circuit, because I imagine at that stage you wouldn't have had a lot of money. Did you have to save up for that, or did you get invited by certain races, or how did that work?
No, luckily enough, my results in Mombasa World Cross Country attracted a manager's interest, and generally our story that what we were trying to do there at the time, it excited him. And Zane ran a track meet in Eldoret, and he broke 4 minutes, which for an 18-year-old breaking 4 minutes there was quite incredible.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he got involved and said, I actually want to bring you guys to Europe to qualify for World Juniors, and we can see where we go from there. So, yeah, that was 2008.
Okay.
We got our first Europe trip.
And then when did the sponsorship first come?
Yeah, that was, I think, sponsorship. We got our first gear deal through our manager. That was 2009, I think.
Yeah, okay. Very good. Now, I've got an interest, like, basically these camps. So the ones that I know of were the ones, so Shaheen, the one that Kipchoge is part of. How many of these camps are there in Kenya? And the questions that I have are, how do you get accepted into those camps? And how do they work in terms of, I'm guessing they cover your rent there and supply food. What are the responsibilities of the athletes? Obviously, they're there just to train, but do they have to do cooking, cleaning, shopping? How does the dynamics of those camps work?
Well, everything's different. Every camp is different, and it depends on how they define their camp. Because some camps, like where I live in E10, is just some guys living together in a rental house. So in that case, they do everything. They buy the food, they cook, they clean, they pay the rent, you know.
Yeah.
But in Kaptagat, these are major camps now that managers have set up. So their managers pay for the camp. Usually they pay for a cook, and the athletes just do their own cleaning. Or some of the athletes, they take their washing home in the weekends to do it their house in Eldoret or something.
Yeah.
But, those camps are pretty organized, and usually they try to limit what the athletes have to do so they can just focus on training.
Yeah. And how many camps have you been part of?
Yeah, I've been a part of, a famous one was Brother Collins, the St. Patrick's camp.
Yeah.
That one I learned a lot from as well. I could speak more about that.
And how did that one work? What were your response? Who did the cooking, cleaning? What were your responsibilities there?
Yeah, we were in a small house off on our own, so me and Zane were doing everything ourselves. But, the training camp, we were part of a smaller group with David Radisha, who had just won the World Junior Championships. So we got to see him rise and how the group worked around him, and
And obviously these camps are based around the top dog in each one. And do you think, because you see this footage of, 300-plus Kenyans going out on one training run, and do you think that leads to a lot of, overtraining within the towns just based on them trying to keep up with somebody who's just way better than them?
It definitely does, but these groups that are, you know, join, like having, you know, 300 plus people join. A lot of them don't show up for hard days, and they'll show up for an easy day and try and pump the easy day.
Yeah, okay.
So, yep. You know, they're kind of like weekend warriors.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? But, yeah, these guys, you know, so, yeah, it leads to a lot of overtraining because the over-competitive athletes sometimes go with the pace every day, even though these fresh athletes are showing up and pushing it.
Yeah.
So it definitely does, and that's why I keep my group to a limited, trustworthy bunch. Where I like to consider everyone in the group my friend, and we all respect each other to a level where we all, you know, we don't push each other over the limit.
Yeah, so let's chat about your camp a little bit. In that, how many athletes are you looking after at the moment?
Usually we're around 8 to 10.
Yep, and what's the quick? Who's the quickest? Are you the quickest, and who's the slowest? Like in terms of times?
No, actually, one of my guys has got a 2:07 marathon.
Okay,
but because he's Kenyan, he's unknown. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And who would be the slowest in the group at the moment?
There's guys who haven't left Kenya, so there's no idea what they can do, and they're still trying to figure out what event. You know, because we got some guys who are still possibly track runners.
Yeah, okay. And so, how do you manage the different abilities there to make sure that maybe the slower runners not trying to keep up with you? Do you use heart rate, or you just try and tell them to run to feel? Or
yeah, like let's use a 40K long run for example. If we're doing 40K, I tell them, okay, today you're doing 20. If you get to 20 and you feel good, you go to 25, you know, stepping stones. So they can get anywhere from 20 to sometimes 35, and you're like, wow, man, you had a good day.
Yeah, so they're running the same pace as you, just not quite as long until they get strong enough.
Yeah, and usually they drop off, and you're like, all right, you got 2 more K until that. So finish there and get in the car so that the car can focus on, you know, getting the drinks to us, etc.
And is that a thing where pretty much every group has their own car? Like, because you see that, and because obviously when I see it, it's based on a video. So you think, oh, maybe a film crew's just taken the car. But are there cars on every training run, like long run?
Yeah, always, because there's always a good athlete who has their own car, and usually they'll get that to follow. Or if it's like me, I hire a Matatu, which is the public van service.
Yep.
So I hire my driver, and he knows how to do the drinks. I've taught him a little bit of photography and filming, so
yeah, okay.
That's how I'm getting my my Instagram feed's going pretty well.
Yeah, we'll get to Instagram a little bit later, because it is quite entertaining actually following your Instagram. And so those athletes that you're responsible for, are you covering their rent, or how's that working?
Yeah, well, obviously the top guys, I mean, they still make enough bucks that I don't need to take care of them, and that's always a good thing. They always have families, and obviously they were not getting supported by me before they came to E10, so their family farming, you know, helps provide for them, and they're there risking it all to, you know, make it big and running. Yeah.
Because at the moment, because you've built a house, haven't you?
Yeah, I've built a house.
And so you live there, just you and your fiancée?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you've sort of gone away from the tough life of the camps. Do you ever think to occasionally go back and just live that tough lifestyle for a bit? Do you think maybe you can become a little bit soft when you have it, you know, have it good now?
No, not really. I think once you've been through it long enough, you never lose it. Some of the guys like Kipchoge, I think they prefer to go out to the camp life, not because they feel like they'll lose that toughness, but because living around the training is, you know, that's motivational, and that gets them out every morning.
Yeah.
Because the roads are, you know, out your door.
Yeah.
That they live in Eldoret. I live in E10, and the training is always out my door. So
yeah, which actually brings me to, because you've trained in E10, Kaptagat. You've trained in Ethiopia as well.
Yes.
Could you give us a rough idea of just, I guess, which place you feel like, if a Westerner, for example, wanted to, you know, have six weeks in Africa, I guess the pros and cons of each of those, if we just look at those three?
If they were to go to Saluta in Ethiopia, which is just outside the main city, then they might get in it more of an experience in Ethiopia like Kenya, because training is out your door. Primarily, you'd have to do it in the dry season, because if it rains in Saluta in Ethiopia, then you're pretty much screwed like everywhere. But in Kenya, training is out your door. If it's Eldoret, you can always get somewhere easily. Kaptagat and E10 are primary places for training. Those are probably better than anywhere else I can imagine, just because I haven't been to Nairobi or these other places that people train.
Yeah. And is Kaptagat and E10 very similar?
Kaptagat is purely farmland and forest. Not too many places to stay. E10 has more hotels and more rental houses and guest houses that are, you know, different ranges of price. So, in a small township with shops, so you can always get some food easily. E10, that's why it's become more of a international training mecca for most foreigners around the world.
Yeah. And I guess advice for Westerners that want to come over in terms of, like, how many different groups train out of E10? Does everyone pretty much train at the same time? What standard of runner do you need to be to make sure that you'd always have somebody to run with on a run? You know what I mean? If you're a 50-minute 10K runner, would there be somebody to run with in E10?
Yeah.
Okay.
If you're like a fun runner, there's always someone to run with in E10.
Yeah.
I mean, most the athletes, some of them know that they're never going to make it big. They're just trying to avoid farm work. okay. So they're out there running, and I mean they would train with foreigners who run 50 minutes, but maybe expect a pair of shoes in return by the time they leave.
Yeah.
You know, it's a little bit of give and take. But, yeah, all professional athletes, they can come and join the groups, and the groups don't usually ask anything of them.
Yep.
Usually, you know, you'll get the one or two athletes asking for a watch or pairs of shoes or something like.
Yeah, okay.
You know, but.
And do most runs always start from the same point at the same time of the day? Is that how it generally works?
Yeah, they usually have routine, 6 a.m., usually 9 or 10 a.m. for speed workouts, like at the track or Farlek. But usually the rainy season changes all that because, you know, the roads all get muddy and those are impossible to train on at those times.
Yeah.
So usually the times of training vary, and it's just communication.
Yeah. All right, couple other quick questions. Do you think you could have become the runner you are today if you had either stayed in New Zealand or went to college in the US?
No, I definitely don't think so. I think as a marathoner and half marathoner especially, I wouldn't have become the way I am today without going to Africa.
And I guess you've sort of proven that, you know, it's not genetics that makes them so good. So if you had to pinpoint maybe two or three things, what do you think it is about training in Kenya that makes you a better runner?
One simply has to be the altitude. Two would be the lifestyle, not in the sense of a hardship or, you know, that they suffer, because, I mean, it makes the mind strong, but the main thing in lifestyle that I talk about is that running is the life. Everything else in life surrounds that. You know, we're thinking about our next training the day beforehand, you know. It's running is the center point.
So less distractions there, because that's, you know, life is pretty simple. So you said, life does revolve around the training.
I mean, that's what I guess what foreigners call them, distractions. But we still go, you know, we still go out to town and that. We just fit it in around our training. So on a hard session day when we don't have anything left in the day, that's when we'll go to town to do something.
Yeah, yep.
And, yeah.
I guess, though, although you've run well this year, you did have, 2015 and 16 was riddled with injuries?
Yeah, pretty much the same one coming back again and again, because there was no real diagnosis.
Yeah, and so I guess most athletes, when they get injured, might go and do, you know, might focus a little bit more on work or things like that. But you're based in Kenya, you're not working. How did you deal with that period of being injured? You know, because you don't work over there. So how did you feel in your time, and what did you learn from those injuries? Anything?
Yeah, I mean, while I was able to train, I was able to, you know, set small goals and see improvements, because I'd always get back in top shape. And I was like, well, I know I'm capable. So I was still encouraged. I was always encouraged by my training that I wasn't stuck in the mud. But time off when you do get hurt, it's all about, you know, the rehab and when you can get back, you know. So it was like, I built myself a goal hoop out of scrap metal, you know. Shot basketball was a hobby of mine, so I just shoot a lot of hoops and try and do other things to keep your mind active. But because
That would have been a period where Zane was running pretty well, wasn't he?
Yeah, Zane was on fire.
And was that hard for you, or that was encouraging for you?
It was encouraging for me, and I knew he'd found his way in Ethiopia as well, so I was hearing a lot of new techniques, and I was willing to try them out once I get back, and, you know, it was exciting for me to see him on top.
Yeah, and just a couple of, so when you mentioned you do gym a couple of times a week, what does your sort of gym work consist of?
Yeah, actually, I have to do gym every day as part of my prehab to make sure my injuries don't come back.
Yeah.
But I do smaller, very small sessions most days before I run. But twice a week or once a week I'll do a bigger session, which is, you know, a huge core set of obliques and center core muscles and squat exercises, kettlebell exercises, hamstring bridges, a lot of quite basic exercises. But I actually put some of that stuff up on my Instagram so people can see if they want.
Okay, so there you go, listeners. You can jump on his Instagram and have a look. What else was I going to say? Do you do much hill sprints and things like that?
Yeah, I used to do a lot more, but that was one reason I got hurt before Fukuoka, I think. So we kind of took it out, because running around, you get enough hills that we don't actually need to do so many hill sessions during race season. We mainly do more hill work sessions in our build-up season.
Yeah, okay. And what sort of length of hills would you do?
We try and find something around 600 meters.
Yeah, yep.
Pretty long hills.
But also, when you do your, you know, 6x3K off a K float, like that's over rolling hills anyway, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which makes a bit of strong. What about the, you know how Canova gets his athletes? So they do like, is it like 10 second max hill sprints at like the end of an easy run? Have you ever done that sort of stuff?
Yeah, that's the stuff we were doing.
Yeah, okay. That you thought got you injured?
Yeah. Just with something else, moving house combined.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I guess now that you've sort of established yourself in Kenya, what's the plan moving forward? Do you see yourself being there like forever, even once you sort of finish running competitively?
No, I don't. There's definitely a lot more good I can do after my running career with coaching and maybe inspirational speaking, something of the sort that, you know, I can still help juniors see a way forward. And yeah.
And so where would you like to base yourself?
I mean, there's always a place for me back in New Zealand. I do like Melbourne a lot in Australia.
Oh, yeah.
It's just, America is always an option because there's so much, you know, so many good jobs there that, you know, but it's really about where the work comes from and where the offers come from, you know, so
yeah.
We'll have to wait till that day to see.
And because you were looked after so well when you, well, I guess in a way you're looked after well, taken in, even though you had it pretty tough early on, do you feel a duty to sort of repay, I guess, the up-and-coming Kenyans now in the way that you were looked after?
Yeah, well, I do take care of my guys and my group. I mean, I provide them with shoes and facilities and stuff like this. So I used to help a lot more people than I do these days, you know, probably because I was a little bit naive and... yeah, they kind of turned their backs on me when I would get hurt and stuff. But, yeah, I help the guys that are really trying to help themselves, you know what I mean? I don't like to give them a fish and say, come back for another, you know? I need to see that they are trying to catch their own.
Does that happen a lot when somebody like yourself has gone from having nothing to, I guess, being pretty well established there now? People are there just looking for handouts?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people are, and it's amazing how many people ask just point blank, and they've never met us before.
Yeah,
they don't know our story, but they just ask because you're a foreigner, you know. But yeah, we've learned to deal with that and kind of just get past that. But yeah, as I was saying, I like to help people who are trying to catch their own fish.
And social media, so you love Instagram, and when did you sort of get into that, and you know, what do you enjoy about the Instagram?
Yeah, I actually only got into it recently. I think it was last year. But yeah, as I learnt the game properly, you know, it became kind of fun to me. Of, you know, I was I did a photography class in high school, and I was pretty good in art, and so I learned a little bit about how to make movies and stuff, and that through watching the guys of Transcend when they did the documentaries and stuff. So yeah, just playing around with photography and videos is my hobby as well. So
yeah,
putting together some inspirational workout videos or photos with some quotes, or you know, also being able to help juniors, junior athletes, you know, be inspired by what I'm doing or see what I'm doing, and you know, occasionally post a training post with my splits of the session.
Yeah,
you know, it's all basically just to help whoever, however they want to be helped, you know?
Yeah.
I enjoy that.
And it's a great attitude to have, because so many professional athletes out there love to keep everything really secretive. And so to almost see what it's like being on the pro circuit through your eyes, that's what you can do with Instagram. And yeah, it just shows a bit of personality, I think, as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, people used to think me and Zane were very strange because we do live in Kenya, until they got to know us. Now they know us, they're all our good mates, so that's really cool. But yeah, people who I've never met before, I feel like I know them and they feel like they know me. We just met in common with games and we're like, yeah, we know each other because of Instagram. Yeah. It's hilarious. But yeah.
And which brings me to, have you ever thought about putting stuff on Strava?
That's one of the running sites.
Yeah, yeah, so through your, I guess through your Garmin, you upload it and it shows you what you've done. Have you ever thought about that?
Yeah, I have. And I tried to link my, honestly, I'm learning as I go, but I tried to link my watch with my phone and then my computer, but something went wrong. And yeah, that's why I ended up just taking photos of my watch. Yeah. And putting those on Instagram because, I was going to use Garmin Connect.
Oh, yeah.
I got to try again.
Yeah, so you can, I think, go into Strava and then basically link your Garmin Connect to Strava. So, yeah, because I'm sure, like, a lot of people out there would really be interested to see what you do on a daily basis. I guess the problem though is, I think I heard Zane say that the GPS doesn't work too well in the forest, so it wouldn't.
That's definitely true. I was just about to say they'd be shocked.
Yeah,
they would say something like pathetically slow or
eight minute kilometers.
yeah, exactly that type of thing.
Okay, we've got maybe two or three more questions. Getting back to that whole positive outlook and relaxed nature, the one thing that really struck me in Biwa was, if you remember, we got taken out to the track where the race started about, was it 2 hours, 2.5 hours before the race started? It was like a long time beforehand. And I was sort of amazed at how relaxed you were and willing to have a chat to myself and Nick Horsbull, the other Kiwi guy. And what is your mentality before a race?
Yeah, I mean, obviously I got my headphones in most of the time and I'm, you know, blazing some music, getting pumped up. But when guys do start chatting and I see that around me, I'm like, oh, I might get involved here, you know. So I came across to you guys and, well, you guys started chatting away and I heard something and we got involved. So
yeah, I think we're talking about upcoming Commonwealth Games or something like that, but it almost relaxed me a little bit knowing that, well, here's a guy who's one of the best in the world. If he can be relaxed and pretty chilled out, then why should I be all uptight about it? So, and noticing the other Africans are always pretty carefree as well, whether it be like at Lake Biwa or even at a call room here in Australia before like an Australian Grand Prix, you know, they're always pretty carefree and they don't seem to I guess get too concerned about it all. You know, it's sort of, it seems fun for them rather than sort of big business or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, I found like I learned a little bit about that from the Africans, how laid back they are, regardless of the situation. But we try and go through the phases in training, like you know, the early wake up, the pre-breakfast, you know, going to training and staying calm and relaxed and then turning up, you know, on the warm-up and getting amped up and,
yeah,
just having a friendly chat sometimes cools everyone down. Usually right before we start our hard sessions in Kenya, we're usually joking, you know, something to just make people calm down a bit, you know.
And last question, you obviously inspire a lot of people, myself included. Like I love the fact that you and Zane have bucked the trend of, I guess, conforming to social norms in terms of, you know, you're a 17-year-old in New Zealand. There's these expectations that you finish high school, either go and study or go and get a trade and go and work. But you've sort of gone, you know what, you only live once. I'm going to go and, you know, try this experience. And it's obviously paid off for you. So you inspire a lot of people. Are there a couple of people out there that have inspired you?
Yeah. In my early days, it was as I watched more and more athletics, I got inspired by Kipchoge. Don't know why. He just inspired me. Bernard Lagat inspired me a lot as well. That was the 2004 Olympics that I was watching, you know, and
yeah,
that was just inspiring. Shaheen he inspired me, and then getting to meet him in the World Cross was like, wow, you know, you're willing to help me if I come to Kenya.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that type of, you know, I want to help you. Yeah, sure, come out.
Yeah.
So,
no, but, yeah, hats off to what you and Zane have done. Like, coming to Kenya is still on my bucket list, and hopefully I can get a leave pass from my wife in the next year or so to come over and experience 4 to 6 weeks before a major marathon. On that, training, going from altitude down to sea level for a race, what's your rule of thumb? How long out before a race do you generally need to go down?
Usually I would try and get pretty close to the race and come down, so I have just over a day, like 2 days before the race.
Yeah.
Just enough to get over the jet lag and feel good again.
When did you get into Japan for Biwa?
Yeah, I think that was 4 days before, and that's because of media. And
yeah.
I mean, these days, you know, most half marathons and marathons want press conferences, and they bring you in a little bit earlier, but that's fine. Again, if it was in Europe, it's, you know, 4 days is, you don't need that much recovery from the jet lag. But
yeah,
from going to Japan or going to America, you need a little, like maybe an extra day or two. So,
yeah. Yeah. And lastly, what's coming up? What's on the radar?
Yeah, just obviously I'm going to be training pretty easy while I'm here in New Zealand for the next month. Then I'm going back to Kenya to prepare pretty seriously for a major marathon. I won't say which one yet, but
yeah,
hopefully I get confirmed sooner than later. But yeah, hopefully I'll get an offer from Great North Run again, and hopefully get another shot at Mo Farah and
you're going to get him this year?
Yeah, hopefully. I definitely want another shot, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's been great chatting to you. Yeah, hopefully we can, I don't know, maybe get you back on one day. And yeah, as I said, I'm hopefully get over to Kenya within the next couple of years to see what it's all about.
Well, make sure you contact me when you do, because I'm actually building a small resort for foreign athletes to come and stay at. So,
yeah, right.
You know, a pretty price, a cheaper price place, just that has more knowledgeable guys around to show athletes like yourself where to train and how to train, and most likely be able to link up with my crew. So
Where when is that expected to be completed?
Probably by the end of this year.
Oh wow, okay. Yep. And is that your own business, or is that in with Zane as well?
We were just speaking about that today, whether we're gonna go tandem or whether we're gonna do our own things, but we might decide to do it together.
Yeah, nice one. Sounds like a good move, and yeah, I'd definitely hit you up, that's for sure. So, but thanks again for your time, and yeah, all the best. We'll chat soon.
All right, cheers.
See you, Jake.
See you, mate. Bye.
All the same, I'll keep on walking. as a young man. Doesn't matter if you're white or black. Just show love to everyone you meet. Doesn't matter if it don't come back. Under the sun.